American policy in the last several administrations has been premised on the idea that American interests lie in bringing stability to the Middle East, and the best way to do that is to achieve democratic governments, which would inherently be sympathetic to the United States. And in, at least in some places, both on the right and the left of politics, hopes for Middle Eastern democracy peaked early this year with the so-called Arab Spring, since when I think we've had considerable disappointment. It was not always so that American administrations believed that stability was in the best interest of the United States. During the 1980s, the Reagan administration did everything in its power to prolong and aggravate the war between Iran and Iraq through covert means. At the time, this is actually a great illustration for those of you who are interested of the difference between German and Yiddish. Henry Kissinger, who thinks in German, was asked which side he wanted to win, and Kissinger said, "I want them both to lose, and we should do whatever we can to arrange that." And then Yitzhak Shamir was asked which side he wanted to win. Shamir, who thinks in Yiddish, said, "I want them both to win." It's my belief, and in the brief remarks we have time for today, the one idea I'd like to communicate is that circumstances, whether we like it or not, compel us to return to the approach of the Reagan administration, which is to live with instability and, in some cases, exploit it for in the interest of American national security, as opposed to trying to stabilize the Middle East, because no matter what we do, we will not achieve stability. The reason we won't achieve stability is because Islam is passing from infancy to senility without going through adulthood. Islamic society is in the middle of a train wreck as it encounters the modern world. The most startling observation that academic demographers made, certainly in my lifetime, perhaps in history, was the sudden collapse of the fertility rate in Iran and some other Muslim countries. But Iran is really worth focusing on because nothing like this has ever been observed in all of demographic history. And there are teams of people, including Iranian academics, trying to explain this phenomenon. Only 20 or 25 years ago, the average Iranian woman bore 7 children. It's now down to about 1.5, and among the educated stratum of society, people with a complete secondary school education or more, it's more like one child per person. Now, if in one generation you invert the population pyramid, you go from having a big base of children, 7 children per family, with a small number of old people, and in 20 or 25 years that turns into a small number of young people and a very large number of old people, you can take the kind of problems that concern us regarding Social Security, Medicare, dealing with an aging population, and multiply it by 100 to get an idea of what kind of economic ruin Iran faces. A country where the average person has $4,000 a year to spend cannot support an aging population. This is not my observation. It's an observation made by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and many people in his circle. Ahmadinejad gives speeches in Persian saying, "The decision of Iranian young people not to have children is an act of genocide against the Iranian nation and it will destroy us in a generation." And inflammatory words like that, which are well justified. Now, Iran is an extreme case, but I'd like to talk about two other countries in this context. One is Turkey and the other is Egypt. Islam is a religion of traditional society. It's a religion of compulsion. The most startling example of this, I think, is the fact that no devout Muslim will repudiate wife beating because it's explicitly justified by the Quran. And in fact, an entire legal and constitutional theory has been elaborated around the problem of wife beating to place it in context of Islamic society. What the Quran specifically says is that the male patriarch, head of household, is the political equivalent of a governor of a province. So he possesses the equivalent of a little monopoly of violence inside the family, just as the governor of a province has the right to inflict violence in this nested hierarchy of entities that are allowed to inflict violence. This is, of course, radically different from the Jewish idea adopted by most Christians that every individual has rights, is sanctified by God, and since every individual stands in direct relationship to God, people have inalienable rights or covenantal rights, which can't be violated. The moment you take Muslims out of a traditional society, particularly women, where compulsion is, including the use of violence, is a matter of daily life, a radical change occurs. Throughout the Muslim world, we find that the moment women get a secondary school education, their birth rate drops to European levels, well below replacement. University-educated women, even lower. So in those countries, like Iran and Turkey, which have a very high literacy rate, you see extremely low fertility rates, very suddenly, almost in precise proportion to the degree of education. In Iran, of course, this was not to Khomeini, but to the late Shah. In Turkey, no thanks to the Islamist AKP party, but to the Kemalist system previously. Turkey is a different circumstance. The Turks, by which I mean people who speak Turkish as a cradle tongue, have the same fertility rate as the Iranians, again, 1.5. And Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, has given speeches in Turkish saying, by 2038, our country will cease to exist at these birth rates. Why 2038, I don't know, but as good a guess as any. The problem, this doesn't show up in the aggregate numbers because the Kurds in eastern Anatolia, who are now 20% of the population, when I say Kurd, it's defined by someone whose cradle tongue is Kurdish, are having 4 or 5 children. Their fertility is roughly 3 times that of the Turks. So within one generation, at that rate, half of military-age Turks will in fact be Kurds. And given the tragic history of oppression against the Kurds by the Turkish state, it seems very likely that the result will be that the map of Turkey will be redrawn. Turkey is not a viable entity. The third country I'd like to talk about briefly is Egypt, which, of course, is the epicenter of the so-called Arab Spring. Egypt has a radically different profile than Iran and Turkey, which have a high literacy rate. The illiteracy rate in Egypt is roughly 45%. About two-thirds of Egypt's population is rural. They're down on the farm. You have a large number of people at universities, but virtually none of them are employable by international standards because the universities are diploma mills used for social control of the young population. And even though the majority of the Egyptian population is engaged directly or indirectly in agriculture, Egypt still imports half of its caloric consumption. After 60 years of rule by military dictators, who employed the standard tactics of dictators to maintain control, keep people rural, illiterate, and powerless, Egypt now faces an economic catastrophe of Somali proportions. The result of the Arab Spring, of course, was to destroy the Egyptian tourist business, which was its most important earner of foreign exchange. The camels that tourists used to ride around the pyramid are now being slaughtered for meat, because the drover, tourist guides can't afford to feed them anymore. And according to a report by one of the European banks last week that appeared in the London Financial Times, Egypt's foreign exchange reserves have fallen from about 6 months import coverage in February of this year to 2 months import coverage as of the moment. There's massive capital flight. General's who run the country appear to be stealing everything that isn't tied down, very similar to what happened in Russia in 1992 and 1993, except Russia was a country that had enormous resources, a great deal of oil, went bankrupt in any case, but Russia never was in danger of starving to death. Egypt is literally in danger of running out of money at a point where 50% of their food is imported. The Western powers have acted, I think, irresponsibly, doesn't begin to describe it with respect to the situation. In May, there was a meeting of the Group of Eight Industrial Nations at Deauville in France, where Nicolas Sarkozy grandly said, well, we've got a $20 billion package for Egypt, and we might double it. Since when, not a word. The entire issue of Egyptian aid has disappeared as Europe worries about more urgent things, like Greece going bankrupt and perhaps also Italy and Spain. And Sarkozy calls Netanyahu a liar. Go figure. So the problem with the Arab Spring in Egypt is an oil-producing country, but it produces a relatively small amount of oil. Countries that begin from that level of backwardness is that as they encounter a modern economy, they go into an economic nosedive from which they may not recover. I think we are likely to see a humanitarian disaster in Egypt of Somali proportions, but with 10 times the number of people involved. And I don't believe that we'll be able to do very much about it, as indeed we were not able to do very much in Somalia. We have a humanitarian catastrophe involving prospectively hundreds of thousands of deaths in Somalia. We can't get food in because it's ruled by Islamist militias and there's no way to distribute aid. So on the one hand, we have the part of Muslim society which is deeply immured in the traditional world, kept backward by dictatorial governments, which encounters economic problems which are not solvable by means that are available to us at the moment. Certainly one factor in this was the secular rise in food prices occasioned by the increase in grain demand from Asia. Egypt's biggest problem is that Chinese pigs will eat before Egyptian peasants. Price of grain has reached a permanently higher plateau because of Asian demand, and that exacerbates these problems. In the case of Iran and Turkey, you have countries which are still functioning. Turkey is about to go through a very nasty economic recession. I have an article about that in Middle East Quarterly coming out without elaborating. Erdogan, like many third world dictators, had the banking system lend to consumers at the 40 or 50% annual rate for a couple of years, which made everybody happy before the elections, but racked up a balance of payments deficit equal to roughly 10% of GDP, which is Greek proportions. That has to be cut back now, so Erdogan's reputation as the author of an economic wizard is going to be severely tarnished, to say the least. But that's really not the major problem Turkey has. Turkey knows that it has a best used-by date, roughly 25 years ahead, where it will be unable to control its ethnic mix because half of its military age population will be Kurds. And Iran knows perfectly well that it will undergo an economic collapse for demographic reasons, particularly as its oil starts to run out at the same time. Just when it most needs revenues, Iran will find itself with severely diminished revenues. Exactly how much is a matter of guesswork. Philip Jenkins, very famous sociologist, specialist in religion in the global South, wrote a piece in the New Republic a few years ago. He was one of the first people to notice this Iranian demographic trend and said, well, isn't this good? An Asian population is likely to be less violent. So in 30 years, Iran won't be a problem. That's probably true, but the next 10 or 15 years are going to be a real problem. Those countries that know that they have no future under the current trajectory are liable to take the most extreme kind of risks to break out of that trajectory because they have nothing to lose. The mentality of the Iranian leadership One does not have to base an argument on apocalyptic views of the imminence of the reappearance of the Mahdi in order to explain the apocalyptic character of Iranian thinking. I see the Iranian leadership much like the position of Adolf Hitler in the early 1940s, who believed that the Aryan race was about to come to an end, and this was Germany's last chance to make a stand in the world, or the position of the Russian leadership in the early 1980s, which knew that it was losing the economic battle to the West, and that it had a very brief window of opportunity in order to assert itself, hence the extremely aggressive actions in Afghanistan, the menacing of Europe, and so forth. Fortunately, the United States stood the Russians down, and the Russians, as good chess players, saw that their position was hopeless, and at a certain point, Mikhail Gorbachev turned the king over and resigned the game. I don't think we're going to necessarily see that kind of rational chess-playing behavior from the Iranians or the Turks. They have nothing to lose, and if they obtain nuclear weapons, I believe it is extremely likely that they will use them against us, against the State of Israel, against the Saudis, or others. So we really are at a watershed moment. From the standpoint of the security of the State of Israel, Egypt is a much smaller conventional threat because economic catastrophe degrades conventional forces. Syria is surely not a threat because, as much of a threat, because its military is too busy murdering protesters in the street to fight Israel effectively. Certainly, Hezbollah and Hamas with their rocket arsenals are a threat, but they're not an existential threat. The existential threat to Israel and threat perhaps to the existence of large American cities comes from Iran. American policy, having found that it cannot stabilize countries that are inherently unstable because they enter a train wreck as they confront modernity, is going to have to find ways to contain these problems. In the case of Iran, my preference would be a bombing campaign to destroy their nuclear capability, which at this point would not be surgical. It would probably mean decapitating the military and political leadership, destroying communications, and occasioning a great deal of collateral damage. A lot of people wouldn't like it, but I think it's necessary. In the case of Pakistan reminds me of the scene in Blazing Saddles, where the black sheriff turns up and the welcoming committee turns into a lynch mob, and he takes his gun out and says, "One more move and the N-word gets it." Pakistan is telling us, in effect, if you let us go into instability, who knows who might get our nuclear weapons? This is a difficult one. Clearly, an alliance with India would be the right way to proceed, but after years of hearing Obama say we don't want American hegemony, the Indians are also appeasing Pakistan. It would take many moves on the political front to deal with the Pakistani situation. In the case of the Arab Spring, where we see countries going into instability and Islamist leadership taking power, which is hostile to the United States, we do not want to stabilize that leadership. We want to destabilize it. Now, that may mean a set of covert operations and judicious use of foreign aid and alliances in situations where humanitarian problems are heart-rending. I wrote this book to harden your hearts and horrify you, because the horrors to come will be something to deal with, and it's better to be inoculated against them first. So with that, I thank you for your attention, and I'd glad to take questions.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Many of you know my name is Joe Skelly. I'm a professor here in New York, and Daniel Pipes has asked me to moderate the discussion period. I'd like to begin by thanking Robert for hosting this terrific event and presentation, and also I'd like to thank David Goldman for his compelling remarks. They're counterintuitive, and at the end, very sobering, but very important. So thank you very much for your comments. And
thank you.
We'll open it up to questions from the floor. Rob.
Dave, what's the basis, factual basis, of the demographic conclusions that underpin what you're saying? Like, where do you get birth rates and that kind of data?
Well, actually, there's a very... The United Nations does a pretty good job of collecting these data and has been calling attention to the extraordinary decline in Muslim fertility for years. If you go to the United Nations Population Prospects website, you can actually download and manipulate this data pretty well. In the case of Iran, there have been a number of studies by international teams, including the Max Planck Institute for Demographics in Germany, a number of cooperating with some local Iranian academics, and demographic group at Princeton. So it's all, I mean, these numbers are pretty hard and pretty well raked over.
Great.
You mentioned Iran and Turkey has nothing to gain. Do they see emigration as a possible, you know, the caliphate issues as a means of getting around that population?
Absolutely, but that would involve redrawing some maps. There are plenty of Turks out there, but not too many of them are in Turkey. There are more than 100 million Turkic peoples outside Turkey. On the border of the former Soviet republics. So it's certainly the case that in the future a wave of Turkish emigration is possible, but that would solve the problem of the Kurds in eastern Anatolia. There already is a huge migration, sort of a joint migration of Turks and Turkic peoples from the old stands to Russia as foreign workers. Russia has probably 10 to 12 million foreign workers, overwhelmingly Turks or people from the stands working there. So, yes, so Turkey has always been a stage for migrations. It's never really been a country. And the next migration is going to probably be they lose part of Kurdistan and they try to get Azerbaijan.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you delve into the Iranian demographic trends a little bit more? Have you seen an increase of population growth under the Ayatollahs versus when Iran was under the Shah, when ostensibly it was more exposed to Western culture as opposed to now? I mean,
well, there's a delayed reaction effect. In fact, there has been a more or less continuous decline of fertility in Iran since the 1980s, and this occurs almost in perfect lockstep with education. The Shah started a huge literacy campaign. He had something called the Literacy Corps, so young men could go to the villages and teach reading and writing instead of going to the army. So that became a significant movement, and they achieved a literacy rate, I think, close to 90%, 88-90%, and that program continued. It was not abolished by Khomeini. So, although, yes, Iran's elites were more Western at the time of the Shah, most of the people were still illiterate. So the delayed reaction effect of modernization is now showing up in lower population trends. But something else is happening in Iran, which is quite alarming. It's probably one of the most demoralized places in the world. There were reports by the Iranian government which were leaked to the German language press, which showed an astonishingly high rate of prostitution. So prostitution is considered a normal part-time job for female university students. Opium addiction rates are astonishing. 5% of the adult population in Iran is addicted to opium, which is, I think, the highest rate in the world. Afghanistan may be high also, but it's an astonishing rate. Various other signs of social anomie are spreading. So the result of this hideous totalitarian theocratic dictatorship has been to create popular demoralization similar to, maybe even worse than what we observed in Russia. When the Soviet Union fell in 1990, we found that there really weren't a lot of communists in Russia outside the Politburo. And there probably aren't many Muslims in Iran now outside the ruling circle and its immediate periphery. According to one report, mosque attendance in Iran is 2% of the population per week, which makes it one of the least religiously observant countries in the world, kind of the level of Estonia. And that would also correlate with very low population.
I think there's also an undercurrent of return to the traditional Iranian religion of Zoroastrianism, somebody pointed out recently.
Perhaps, but I don't have numbers on that.
We'll go to Robert and then over to this side of the room. Thank you for your patience. Robert.
Well, this is all wonderful bad news. I know you mind the Mae West quip, too much of a good thing is great. Can you talk a little bit about water? We've heard Daniel Pipes talk about the importance of this, and maybe you have some additional details on what's going to happen to the Nile. My understanding is that the headwaters of the sources of the Nile are not under Egyptian control. And what would happen? I gather in the Middle East, many places are running out of water. Can you perhaps talk a little bit more about water in the Middle East?
Well, I think in a couple of generations, no one is going to have much business living in the Middle East who can't desalinate water in large amounts. The headwaters of the Nile has been a political issue for a long time, and American influence in places like Ethiopia could certainly be brought to bear were we to have a hostile regime in Egypt. There hasn't been a lot of discussion about it in the last few months because everyone is sitting waiting to see what happens in Egypt. It's really not an area of my expertise, but I think the Israeli progress in that area is another demonstration of why Israel's economy is going to do well and places like Syria are going to do very badly. Even before, one of the reasons for the uprising in Syria is Bashar Assad, in attempting to reform Syrian agriculture according to standards imposed on him by the European community in order to enter into free trade agreements, ended up leaving several hundred thousand former farmers, displaced farmers, in tent cities around Damascus. Syria is chronically short of water, hasn't done enough to provide it, and the agricultural crisis in Syria is certainly a major factor leading up to the rebellion against Assad. But apart from that, I really don't have a lot to add.
Sir?
I've never seen birth rate snap back, number one. And it's, I guess, you know, bad good news that the Arab, Muslim, Iranian birth rates are collapsing. But at least they're collapsed, and they seem to have collapsed after the West, including the U.S., with the exception of the evangelicals, Mormons, recent immigrant Hispanics. So yeah, it's happening, but it's kind of... At least they got a couple decades.
Birth rates have snapped back when the cause of lower fertility was a temporary condition like an economic depression, for example. So you had very low birth rates in the 1930s and then the baby boom afterwards. You had a lot of catch-up. In the case of the Muslim world, there is no particular temporary condition, there's no event which you can blame for the change in birth rates. There's an enormous academic literature which shows that education, literacy, is really the driving factor, and that's true whether you look across countries, cross-sectionally, or you look at different cohorts within each country. Wherever there's data, it's an extremely compelling case. So this appears to be a long-term secular trend motivated by, you know, glacial movements at the social level. It's not clear to me how that would snap back. Regarding the United States, you can certainly make an argument that America is only the leper with the most fingers. But I don't think that would be a completely viable argument. One of the things that liberal and conservative sociologists agree on is that faith and fertility are closely linked. People of faith have more children. That's true in Europe as well. People of faith in Europe have children at the same rate that people of faith do in the United States. Simply, there aren't that many of them. There's no argument about that, and America is still a much more religious country, so it's not surprising that more religious groups, like the evangelicals, who are, after all, 25% of the population, have, I think, 2.6, 2.7 children, while mainline Protestants or loosely affiliated Catholics tend to breed like Europeans. The most extreme example, of, as usual, is the Jews. Secular or loosely affiliated Jews have a fertility rate of 1 to 1.2, The modern Orthodox are generally estimated at between 3 and 4, and the ultra-Orthodox, you know, 7 or 8. So the question is, will America continue to be a religious country, or will it secularize like Europe? I don't have an answer to that. I believe that our history tells us that America is much more naturally hospitable to religion, particularly more hospitable to Christianity than Europe, because it's a non-ethnic nation. Our conception of religion was never corrupted by ethnicity. So we certainly have a shot at this. But predicting what will happen to the United States in the second half of the century clearly is above my pay grade. The one thing you can say is that the momentum is so much in our favor that, you know, you could say with certainty we'll be the only major industrial country with a larger workforce in 2050 than we have now. Japan will be down by a third, Europe by a quarter. So the idea that America is going to decline relative to the rest of the industrial world is, in my view, a silly proposition. The numbers, whatever may befall us, is going to start affecting demographic trends after 2050.
Including China in that?
Well, you know, China's a very strange case because the number of highly educated, highly skilled Chinese is exploding. But the actual number of Chinese will shrink at some point because of very low fertility. But so many Chinese, two-thirds of the Chinese population are basically non-actors in the economic stage. They're very poor farmers in the interior of China. It's roughly a third of the Chinese population that's created the economic miracle. So, you know, China has 50 million classical music students, 35 million piano students. It has an astonishing number of really smart and well-trained people coming out of its university system. I've seen the change in those graduates over 20 years, you know, as a hiring manager in Wall Street. So we still have a tsunami coming of Chinese talent, despite the fact that out of that, you know, 1.3 billion people, you do have major aging and shrinkage problems. In the average, it's a very unique case, and it's very hard to sum up all the effects.
Sir, and then Matt.
Yes. So all the Arab populations in the Middle East are the birth rate is going down, as well as the Turkish rate, but the Kurdish rate, you said, is not. It's going up, and the Israeli Jewish birth rate is going up. So those, well, why is the Turkish, the Kurdish, and the Israeli Jewish going up, but all the surrounding birth rates are going down?
The main reason the Kurdish birth rate is so high is because most of the Kurds are very poor, very uneducated, and immired in traditional society. People in traditional society always have lots of kids, and the Kurds are live in the most backward part of Turkey. I also think there's probably an element of national feeling on the part of the Kurds. They also tend to be devout Muslims, which propels that. But, you know, the Turks just haven't done a whole lot of research in Kurdish areas. I wonder why. We know what the aggregate numbers are, but we don't have anything like a longitudinal survey of attitudes. In the case of the Israelis, this certainly surprised everybody. The demographic time bomb turned out to be working in our favor. Not the other side's favorite. This is after Yasser Arafat told us the Muslim movement overwhelm us, and Gaddafi said this, and no such thing happened. And I had lunch with a friend from Jerusalem about 3 weeks ago, and he said people are now saying, the Tel Aviv kids are now saying, 4 is the new 3. It used to be if you're really nationally motivated, you have 3 kids, but now people are talking about having 4 kids. Israel is just the most happy, optimistic, positively inclined place in the world. And people love kids. I mean, you know, I think also even secular Israelis are, by other standards in the world, have more commitment to religious faith in some way than secular people anywhere else.
You're saying it's, that's nothing to do with education levels. That's we're talking
nothing about. Nothing at all. Except, religion, of course, the Haredi don't go to university and they have tons of kids, so there's that one discontinuity. But no, Israelis of all education levels, all income levels, are having lots of kids.
But why now? Why is the grade going up now? It hasn't been, it's been, you know, it was stable for a while, but it's been going up lately. Why specifically now?
I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. But I'm happy it's happened.
Yeah. While your projections of numbers are encouraging, I think that out of the billion Muslims, let's say there are billion Muslims in the world now, the problem of the world and of Israel is because of a fraction of radicals. You don't need to really have in a billion, you know, but a fraction of a percent that are throwing the world into a havoc. Isn't the problem inherently with the Muslims? And an author by the name Irshad Manji wrote a book, The Problem with Islam Today, where she says that it is the idea that you cannot question Islam, and therefore they have never gone through a renaissance of ideas, of questioning. Because whether we have a billion or 750 million, if we have 100,000 that are completely into, you know, killing everybody because there's no, they don't care, as you said, about the, they see the end, you know. What's the meaning of less Muslims out there?
Well, you can have Somali conditions in Egypt, and it may have no effect at all, for example, in Israeli security. They, you know, what are they going to do? They probably can't buy spare parts of the F-16s as it is. But if the Iranian regime acquires nuclear weapons, there's a lot that this minority can do. So the real existential threat to Israel is Iran and weapons of mass destruction, particularly nuclear weapons. If Iran gets nuclear weapons, I think it is much more likely to use them. And you know, there's another logic, too. Henry Kissinger has said on many occasions, I think, and this is exactly right, that if Iran gets them, several other powers will get them. And if you have a multiplayer game with many people possessing nuclear weapons with very poor command and control, the probability is essentially one that at some point they'll be used. And a country like Iran, which has an apocalyptic sense of its own prospective demise, as indeed Hitler did in 1944, deterrence may not be the solution. Deterrence worked pretty well with Russia. They were rational actors. But remember, you know, two-thirds of German army casualties occurred in the last 8 months of the war. It's a frequent case that most casualties occur after the war is already hopeless, but people would rather die than admit they've been defeated. That was true, you know, even in the American South during the Civil War. All the more so should we worry about a regime like Iran, which knows that its approach gets best used by it, and may feel it has nothing to lose. So it's always going to say, okay, the Muslims will, you know, die out and eventually, and there won't be a problem. Yes, in the very long term, they're dead and everyone else is dead, except, of course, the Jewish people, which is eternal. But in the next 10 or 15 years will be some of the most dangerous that we will live through because of this. I mean, this is not necessarily good news. It's dangerous because it's dangerous for everybody.
Very serious.
Yes.
So recently, I guess, some Iranian missile scientists and so forth have been mysteriously assassinated. I don't know who did it.
I didn't do it.
But according to Amir Tahiri in the Persian Night, the reason Khamenei is the grand Ayatollah is that he was seventh in line, I think, and the six guys ahead of him all got killed after Khomeini died. So what are what's the possibility of taking out the regime, and what would the effect of that be?
My friend Michael Ledeen writes about this all the time and is very optimistic that it could be done. I really don't know. Clearly, the Revolutionary Guards are a compact force. If you have a monoculture economy where all the money comes from oil, rugs and pistachios are next. So effectively, all the money comes from oil. The government controls all the oil. One source controls all the money. They control all the guns. It's very difficult to take down a regime like that, which has that much power, even if it has minority support, even if the support is a small minority. Very hard to overthrow it from the inside. Whether it's possible, I don't know, and I certainly hope we're making every effort we can. My view is, why take chances? Take them out, take out the nuclear capability by air yesterday.
And if that happens, I mean, is it true when one reads that the Iranian population actually tends to be pro-American? In other words, if you get the regime out, Iran wouldn't necessarily be a mortal enemy.
Perhaps not. There are many pro-American Iranians. There are many anti-American Iranians. However, whatever happens, Iran is facing ruin. It's not going to be important to America. It's not going to be an important country. When we took out the Soviet Union, I was in Russia extensively in 1992 and 1993. I was working for a politically connected consulting firm which pulled some strings and got me a card that said I was an advisor to the Russian finance minister I'd ever met. Like all the Reagan types who are running around trying to sell American free enterprise to all these other folks. Russia was in chaos. We destroyed Russia. We turned the women into whores. We turned the men into drunks. We turned everyone in power into a thief. Russia still is. It's a dynasty. We destroyed Russia. We won the Cold War and we ruined the country. And we produced, the communism produced the misery, but we accelerated a decline which caused untold human suffering, and it was the right thing to do because we had to take out that danger to the United States. We were not, we were not being the Salvation Army in Russia. We were an enemy, forcing them to their knees and humiliating them. And that's what's going to happen to Iran one way or the other. This is a country whose the best of whose elite has left, the worst brain drain in the world. It has a rapidly aging population, profound social problems. It's running out of oil. Whatever happens to it is not going to be pretty. I just want to make sure that there are no ancillary complications from its decline, like nuclear bombs going off in New York City, or God forbid, Tel Aviv. Okay.
We're all in agreement.
This is going to be
25, 30 years, and they're cooked demographic. That's the time frame.
We'll go from this side of the room to Matt.
Could you please comment on, given Turkey's dire straits, you believe is going to forcefully take over Cyprus for the gas, and then from there try to grab the gas that Israel has declared?
I don't think they will, simply because the United States and the European community wouldn't stand for it. As a NATO member, there are a great number of constraints on their doing so. So I think, left to his own devices, I'm sure Erdogan would like to, but I can't imagine that this would be permitted. I think 10, 15 years down the road, Turkey is going to be giving Azerbaijan, which has a lot of oil, a very hairy oil. And when I say the map will be withdrawn, I think what ultimately the Turks are looking at is allowing Kurdistan to split off and try to link up with their Turkish-speaking neighbors in countries that have plenty of oil. So I think we're going to have wars and changed maps and population migrations, a really chaotic situation. My template for that would be the 30 Years' War of 1618 to 1648, a prolonged period of chaos. And the case of Turkey, if we have something to do with it, we should not let them take over our airport.
Yes, ma'am.
You talked wonderful to my ears that you speak more about going on the offensive rather than always being on the defensive.
Yes.
And while all these dictators are down and the countries that we know of are all weakened, do you think that, and the Muslim Brotherhood is going to get in, etc., and is in some places, do you think that Israel should be more on the offensive and go in and, for example, take back the Sinai or do something else? Or what should Israel do? And rather than look in hindsight and say, well, while their defenses were down, we should have done this and that while the Muslim Brotherhood prevented it. What should we take back?
I'm very reluctant to give advice to the Israelis because they have so little maneuvering room and everything they do has an enormous cost. I'm not sure what taking back the Sinai would do at this point. I mean, there are ways to, there's no, whatever border they have is going to be the subject of pinpricks, but there's no existential threat from Egypt. Egypt has no weapons of mass destruction. It doesn't have an army or air force that can seriously threaten Israel, and its military capacities will be degraded as the economic crisis proceeds. Same with Syria. So if in the case of Egypt, I think the best thing Israel can do is stand back and let them, you know, sort out their own problems, which really means going to chaos. In the case of, you know, the big issue may turn out to be Hezbollah in Lebanon. That's always been an issue. Or missiles from Syria. So Israel have to conduct an incursion, possibly at some time, but I think clearly not now. The other great issue, of course, is all the rumors about Israel attacking Iran. That's something which I can't possibly comment on because the logistical issues are so complex. I mean, I certainly don't have information on that, and people who know don't talk. So I don't think Israel should have to, I think the United States should do it. Whether Israel physically can do it without the use of tactical nuclear weapons is a question outside my competence, and it's hard for me to imagine that under present circumstances Israel would preemptively be the first user of nuclear weapons. I just can't imagine that happening. So I think the best thing for Israel to do at this point, apart from putting viruses into the Iranian nuclear program, is to build a lot more unmanned aerial vehicles and improve its border defenses and so forth. I think really the next move is going to be economic collapse. I mean, real collapse in Egypt and more deterioration in Syria. And for the moment, I think Israel should probably just gauge the situation and watch.
And in the back, Matt.
Oh, I came late, so forgive me if I missed this. But you say if Iran gets the bomb. But I've heard it's not if, but when, and that estimate is anywhere from 6 months to 2 years, and it's not a long way away. And how seriously do you take, and you may have already addressed this, Ahmadinejad's repeated vow to annihilate Israel?
I take it extremely seriously, and my argument was that because Iran has a very well-founded sense of its own imminent decline because of its demographic implosion, it's likely to be as suicidal, say, as the Nazi leadership was in the 1940s. And were they to acquire deliverable nuclear weapons, they almost certainly would be used against Israel, against us, or against other people. And the most urgent single item on the American agenda is to destroy the Iranian nuclear program, which I think we should do by an aerial attack starting yesterday.
Do you not think that would bring in other players that may have a vested interest in Iran's hegemony in the area?
Would the Chinese really be upset about it? Yes, sure they'd be upset about it. You know, you can't please everybody. Lots of people would be really upset about it, but what is anyone going to do about it? You know, what would be the consequence? One of the reasons the excuses we always had for not attacking Iran was articulated most clearly by the former head of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen, in a 2009 interview with Charlie Rose, in which he said, gee, if we attack Iran, look at all these American troops we've got in Iraq and Afghanistan, they'd become targets, and all these American assets would be attacked by Iran. Well, yes, Iran has lots of ability to hurt us. They've got terrorism, they've got assets in Iraq and Afghanistan, they probably have sleeper agents in the United States. There's no doubt in my mind that we would take damage, that Iran would find ways to retaliate against us. But all of these would be manageable, whereas a nuclear explosion in an American city is not what we would call manageable.
Okay, we have plenty of time, so we're just going to continue to go back and forth.
In favor of taking care of Iran, but I'm also wondering if that empowers the Saudis, and you know, given their propensity to caliphate and education within the United States and for jihad and all that sort of thing. Do we really require a balance of power between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
No, I agree with the lady, Tom Shamir. I want them all to win. So the Saudi regime, one of the most evil, unpleasant, oppressive regimes in the world, but they are not in any way an existential threat to the United States. They are an occasional annoyance because they pay bakshi to terrorists. Now, there are ways to discourage them from paying bakshi to terrorists. I can think of a number of them, but I'm not going to say them out loud. You have, Saudi Arabia is run by 3,000 people. We know who they all are. We know where they live. Just leave it at that. Discouraging them is not a logistically challenging proposition. So, you know, let them go out and let them take advantage of Iran's decline. Then we worry about them later.
Brian.
Can you just discuss the Islamization of Europe and Urania?
Islamization of Europe. This is a very, very differentiated picture. The worst problem is in England. As a matter of fact, Melanie Phillips addressed this group a few years ago when she published her excellent book, Londonistan. The Pakistanis still have one of the highest fertility rates in the Muslim world at 4. And unlike other immigrants to Europe, when they come to England, they still have 4 children. They are the most persistent escapees from traditional society. They don't change. And the English have been probably more outrageous than anyone else. The point that Daniel Pipes has made in many occasions in accommodating Muslim sentiment. So England really is doing astonishing things. The last atrocity, which I'm sure many of you saw in the news, is that the British, the London Metropolitan Police, exempted Muslim policemen from guarding the Israeli embassy. So Muslim policemen don't affect Jews in England. Astonishing. France is very hard to know what's going on. I think the Islamization of France can be a bit exaggerated. The Senegalese have a fertility rate of 8 or 9 in Senegal, and within 10 years of emigrating to France, it goes down to 3. So you had a bulge in Muslim birth, but it appears to be attenuating in France. The Turks in Germany very quickly start breeding like Germans. In fact, back in Turkey, they're breeding like Germans. So the Turkish takeover of Germany has slowed down substantially. It's not quite as rapid a problem as many of us had feared. There's a lag, of course, between the decline of European birth rates, decline of Muslim birth rates. Europe spent 200 years going through the great demographic transition, and then dipped even further, well below replacement in the last generation. Muslim countries are going from having huge fertility rates, 6, 7, 8, to 4, 3, 2, and in some cases down to 1.5. So simply the time lag is going to lead to a much higher Muslim population in Europe. But it's not quite as one-sided as some of the Arabia discussions have been. There are some countries where the Europeans are so good at corrupting Muslim immigrants that they'll end up behaving like the Europeans too. Germany being a prime example.
So,
I wonder if you could say a word about the sources of Iranian antagonism towards Israel. It doesn't seem to be based on national interest during the time of the Shah. Israel and Iran made common cause against Arabs. So is it a cynical play for leadership within the Islamic world, or is it based on something else?
I think it is a play for leadership in the Islamic world, but it is an impassioned play. Iran sees this period in history as the Shiite moment. Shiites were always the underclass in Islam. They were poor, they were kicked around, particularly in Lebanon, Pakistan. They were always an ill-treated, poor caste within Islam, and their one state center was Persia. Shiism was associated with Persian nationalism. Iran wants a Shia crescent from the Mediterranean through to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And to do that, they have to take leadership of the Muslim world. And I don't think it's cynical at all. From a Muslim standpoint of religious Muslim, the existence of the Jewish people, particularly the existence of a Jewish state with its capital in Jerusalem, is an unacceptable state of affairs. The authority of the Quran, I forget who mentioned this before, the authority of the Quran as divine writ is a glass link, a very breakable, fragile link in the entire ideological structure of Islam. That's why, for example, no one can repudiate wife beating. The Muslim assertion is that all the other scriptures were falsified by the Jews and Christians, and that the true revelation was given to the Muslims in the 7th century. If the Jews have not been relegated, have not been superseded, but their prophecy appears to be validated by the return to Zion, then this is a real blow to Muslim self-confidence, to the point where Muslim self-confidence is extremely challenged in any case. So I don't believe that devout Muslims will ever tolerate the state of Israel for that reason.
In the back, sir.
Should Israel annex the West Bank?
Well, you know, personally, it would make me happy if they could get away with that. But this is simply the wrong time to stick their neck out in that kind of business. And Israel's in a situation where its two principal neighbors and former enemies, Syria and Egypt, are in chaos. So the best thing for Israel is to allow its environment to deteriorate and then pick its targets opportunistically based on the evolution of events. I don't think any Israeli diplomatic or military action which would appear as aggressive at the moment is necessary. This is actually a very strong situation in terms of its immediate environment. So why do anything? Why not just let your enemies weaken and fight among each other, and then you can decide what to do later?
These two gentlemen. Okay.
There might be two sides to your answer. Why do it now? Because it's unexpected. Perhaps the best time for success is to do something when it's not expected. That's my personal opinion, and I certainly have no background in warfare to say that. However, it seems to me, whenever you think Israel should strike, or whenever I feel they should strike, it's the wrong time. When they shouldn't strike, that's the right time.
Well, you know, we're going to have an enormous increase in Israeli population if these birth rates persist. If you go to the UN website, you know, you can just look at their calculations of future population based on constant fertility. If you take Israel and you take what they call the constant fertility scenario and project things forward, there will be 25 million Israelis in the year 2100 with a fertility rate of three children per woman. What do you do with 25 million people? we'll probably have to recolonize Poland, which at that point will
be all empty.
And with a fertility rate of 1.3, Poland's population will have fallen by half by the end of the century. The average age will be 60. So, and there will be as many Poles as Israelis.
I think worrying about the population on the part of Israel 25 years from now doesn't exist in their mind. They're concerned with tomorrow.
Well, no, that
they know what they're surrounded by and where it can come from. And if they're thinking that in 25 years someone's going to hit us, they're a winner. They're not thinking 25 years ahead.
No,
they're thinking about next week.
In general, I think we're going to see so many radical changes. Maps are going to be drawn and redrawn many times in the Middle East, that it simply doesn't make sense to try to guess everything out in advance. This is a brawl. This is a breakdown. Social disintegration in many countries. So that kind of situation you play by, you improvise. You improvise and adapt based on circumstances which are inherently unpredictable.
And then, gentlemen.
Yes. Would you please amplify your U.S. policy recommendations on Pakistan and Afghanistan?
Well, the key to Pakistan is India and China, and to some extent Russia, India and China. The Chinese don't like Pakistan at all because Pakistan is training Uyghur terrorists who are making trouble in Xinjiang, so-called East Turkestan, as the Turks like to call it. They have 100 million Muslims. They're restive. They're a pain in the neck, and they're separatists. The Chinese have a horror of separatists because China's not really a country. It's an empire, and if one province breaks away, who knows who else might break away. That's why they're so hysterical about Taiwan. So the Uyghur terrorist problem, which the Pakistanis are exacerbating and the Chinese have publicly complained about, is a major issue. That gives us common ground. Sit down with the Chinese and say we have to sanitize this problem jointly. Chinese have also been helping the Pakistanis with their nuclear program, which is irresponsible and stupid. The Indians, even after all of the outrageous terrorist acts sponsored by Pakistan, which we know were sponsored by Pakistan, are appeasing Pakistan because the United States shows no interest at all in punishing Pakistan for outrageous actions, including terrorist attacks on the American embassy in Afghanistan. So if we're not doing anything, the Indians are going to say, well, you know, we might as well cut our own deal on the side. So this government, the present Indian government, is extremely wishy-washy towards Pakistan. It's complex because we have to find ways to maneuver both India and China into an arrangement that scares the pants off the Pakistanis. They have to understand their downside is they're partitioned or they're destroyed. Our policy of Pakistan should be encirclement. We should do exactly what they fear the most. We should have brought India into Afghanistan from the beginning and scared the hell out of the Pakistanis. They have to understand we're willing to let the sheriff blow his head off. They have to be really afraid of us, that we are willing to put them into at existential risk. But it's not that easy to do that ourselves because we're not the only actor in that part of the world. So it's a complex problem. Ultimately, India and China have interests that at least coincide with us sufficiently for this to be possible diplomatically, but it's a complex equation, and it's hard to do because after all these years of the Obama administration saying, there's no American exceptionalism, you know, that's like Greek exceptionalism, we don't want to run the world, we don't want hegemony, we don't want balance of power, we want to be like a humanitarian NGO. We've got a lot of repair to do in terms of our strategic position to get to the point where we can do that to Pakistan. So pardon the long answer, but it's a complex problem.
How about Afghanistan? Could you just follow up on
Afghanistan? Just seal the border and forget about them. I mean, there's no possible way of stabilizing that mess. We should have special forces operating there. An 80 tribal leader with 100 guys who wants to fight another tribe, we should get some AK-47s.
As many have said, you can't buy a tribe, you can rent them.
Yes.
we have a comment, and then Hillel in the back.
I just want to address your question about the Israeli demography. The Israelis are very, very sensitive to their demography and to the growth of their population, and they have they do many, many population studies. But the problem within the Israeli population is the biggest growth area is in the ultra-religious groups and in the Arab sector, and neither one of them serves in the army.
Well, you know, the latest research shows that the secular population in Israel is also growing. Very quickly. And the secular, if I recall, the secular fertility rate, when you say secular, it means someone who's, you know, who's not ultra-Orthodox, basically, well, not national religious, but secular fertility rate is non-Haredi Jewish fertility rate is around 2.6, 2.7. About the same as the American evangelicals. Now, the Haredi are at 7 or 8, but they're still a relatively small part of the population. So most of the growth is actually coming, most of the numbers of babies are coming from non-Haredi.
What's the attrition rate among Haredi? So of those 7 or 8 children, how many of those children become secular?
I don't know.
Negligible. It's probably very negligible. It can't be much.
We have time for two more questions.
It's the same thing as here. Look at the Orthodox populations here.
Hillel, and then, sir?
I hope I'm not misquoting you. I believe you said that sociologists from both the left and the right have determined that there's this connection, a nexus between faith and fertility.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could just give us a couple of bullet points as to why there is this connection between faith and fertility. Or the flip side of it, why there is, among people who are secular, they're not breeding as well. Is it they're so self-absorbed that they, you know, can't bother having children? What is the connection there?
There's a secular sociologist named Eric Kaufman, who I'm trying to see if I can. Yes, he wrote a book called "Will the Religious Inherit the Earth," which is a Jeremiad, if you can talk about a secular Jeremiad, about the collapse of fertility among secular people. And he's terrified that all that will be left will be religious people. What he says is that the weakest link in the secular account of human nature is that it fails to account for people's powerful desire to seek immortality for themselves and their loved ones. We may not be able to talk about how, you know, our longevity has improved so much, and he says we may not be able to duck death completely, but it becomes so infrequent that we can easily forget about it. Now, in fact, the last time I checked, the mortality rate was still 100%. I think he's exactly right that human beings are not Hobbesian man, who's interested in self-preservation as an individual, and we're not Freudian man, who's interested in sex, and we're not Adam Smith man, who's interested in money. We're Viktor Frankl man. We're biblical man. We want something beyond our earthly existence to matter. And people who lack faith in something beyond themselves tend to act like the Europeans. Why not just have what fun we can now? Why take all the trouble and heartache of raising kids? Plus, not to mention the expense. I think it's that simple.
Excellent. Ken.
Hi, Kenneth Brownwitz. I have a question back on what you had said about Admiral Mullen, who was a loyal American, Gates, loyal American. They came in under Bush, who was a loyal American. We now have a nutcase in the White House, but that's a different story. But relative to Iran, Iran's an existential threat to America, existential threat to the people here, existential threat to our military power. It's basically a suicide bomber country, so to speak, with a terror organization with a nuclear bomb. Why didn't the military say, we can't tolerate a nuclear Iran, we have to preemptively go in and blow up their nuclear sites. We can't wait till they blow up America and then feel happy that we'll blow them up after everyone's dead in this country. Oh,
there are tons of people in the Pentagon who think exactly that way, but I think we really got ourselves into a trap. I think the political science which guided the Bush administration, the idea that democracies don't make war and that democracies are inherently sympathetic to the United States. Not just Bush. I mean, Nathan Sharansky thinks that. A lot of people I like and admire think that. I just happen to disagree with them. That got us into the nation-building exercise in Iraq. And once you have several hundred thousand American soldiers in Iraq, a place where Iran has enormous resources on the ground, they de facto became hostages to Iran, and then political considerations kicked in. Right before the elections, Bush wasn't going to do something that might lead to a lot of American deaths and a rise in oil prices and a lot of chaos. There was certain political cynicism. And then, of course, Obama came in. Obama has a profound personal sympathy and liking for Muslim countries. There's no way that he's going to go after the Iranians. He didn't even support the democracy movement in Iran in 2009, which would have cost him nothing. He could have just said something. That was disgraceful. So I think we worked ourselves into a trap by starting out with well-meaning but incorrect premises. And now to get out of that trap will be costly and messy. I don't want to minimize how nasty the consequences would be, both in terms of retaliation against us and in terms of collateral damage on the ground, by which I mean innocent people being killed. Forget the euphemism. But we have to do it nonetheless.
Well, thank you. I'd like to thank David, Robert,